Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
When it comes to kicking the fossil habit, the scales don't lie. In 2024, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increased by 3.5 parts per million. That is the biggest jump since 1957, when Keeling's Mauna Loa lab started accurate records. It's the highest we've ever seen. Humans continue to hit the accelerator on global warming. This week, real scientists speak. From New Zealand and the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, Dr. Kevin Trenberth talks ocean heating, new science, and his provocative new article. But first, we run away into the past. Oregon State University Professor Peter Clark just published Global Mean Sea Level Over the Past 4.5 Million Years. Can we find a rearview mirror that helps predict our future? Here we go. It's Radio EcoShock. As the first humans evolved, big ice dominated the world. Before that, scientists found a warm period with carbon dioxide levels similar to today. In that ancient warming, sea levels were 20 to 25 meters, that's 65 to 80 feet higher than they are right now. Is our future to be found in that past? Scientists using new advances just released a study, Global Mean Sea Level Over the Past 4.5 Million Years. It also tells us about ice, oceans, and Earth in space. The lead author is Dr. Peter U. Clark, Distinguished Professor of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University. He is also Professor of Quaternary Studies at University of Ulster. From Corvallis, Oregon, Peter Clark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
Why do we need a time map of sea level for the last few million years?
It's something that scientists and specifically paleoclimatologists and paleo-oceanographers have been working on for a long time, since the first discovery of the ice ages back in the middle of the 19th century, largely by Louis Agassiz. And so we've known that since then that glaciers and ice sheets used to be larger than they are now, and so that led to understanding or interest in understanding why that was the case, how that could have been the case, and what caused those changes in the size of glaciers and ice sheets. And, of course, changes in the size of glaciers and ice sheets correspond to changes in sea level, because the water that is used to grow the ice, or as the ice melts, the water from that melting, is coming from and going back to the ocean. So that corresponds to causing sea level to change. So it's a long-term question, and it's driven by curiosity, scientific curiosity, as to basically understanding how the Earth system works and how it has changed, why it's changed through Earth history.
So in this back and forth of ice growing and retreating on this planet, where would we be now without human interference?
We would be in almost exactly the same place. So human interference with the climate system is a very recent and short-lived phenomenon. It's never, of course, happened before in Earth's history to the extent that it is, and that the reason is that the major interference is from our burning of fossil fuels, causing an increase in carbon emissions and CO2 in the atmosphere. So humans, as they've been on the planet, have affected the local landscapes and the local environments, but nothing to the extent of what's happening now at the global scale. But nevertheless, it's really only in the last 150 years that influence has been significant. And that's just a very short speck of time with respect to the last 4.5 million years, for example. So the scale of which the changes that have occurred so far due to human activities are very, very small as compared to the natural changes that have occurred in the past.
But would we be heading towards a new ice age or carrying on with the warming anyway?
So that's been a very interesting question since, the interference with the climate system by humans is first really widely appreciated, recognized. is that the coming and going of the ice ages in the past has been due to natural causes, and those are largely attributed to changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun. So those changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun and their influence on climate is very well known through detailed calculations by astrophysicists. So we know those changes as they've occurred over the last 50 to 100 million years, and we also know how those changes will play out in the next 10 million years. So with that understanding, and without human influence on the climate system, the projections are basically that the next ice age or glaciation cycle, such as we've experienced in the past, would probably not occur for another 50,000 years or so. But due to the increase in CO2 in the atmosphere due to our activities, burning fossil fuels, and assuming that that CO2 is not removed somehow by humans and stays up in the atmosphere, which is what it does. This is the main fundamental problem with CO2, is not only is it causing global warming today, but at the same time, it will continue to cause global warming in the future because so much of it stays in the atmosphere once it's released there and only comes out of the atmosphere through natural processes very gradually. That effect, if it was not mitigated in some way, would delay the next ice age even more than the next 50,000 years, perhaps 100,000, 150,000 years or something. So in either case, either due to natural changes or with the added effect of humans that are not mitigated in some way, the next ice age will be a long ways out in the future.
Well, that's going to be a big disappointment to all the YouTube alarmists who have been saying, oh, the next ice age is going to happen next year or something. It's crazy what's out there. So meanwhile, scientists are trying to investigate a particular warm period called the mid-Pliocene warm period, or MPT. When was that, and why do we want to understand what happened then?
So the mid-Pliocene warm period, the MPWP, if that's what you're referring to, it occurred about 3 million years ago. Is that what you're referring to? Yeah. So that's actually just a fairly, it's interesting because the Pliocene itself, which is the period of time prior to the Pleistocene, which is the time when these large sea level fluctuations were occurring, and which just ended about 12,000 years ago. So the Pliocene prior to that, which started about 5 million years ago and it continued until about 2.6 million years ago, was in general a time of warmer climates, warmer temperatures than present, and higher sea levels than present. And the particular interval that scientists have focused on, this mid-Pliocene warm period, is just a short, brief period during the overall Pliocene. And they've sort of targeted that particular time as a detailed focus of their study as to why explaining that particular time. But their understanding of what caused it would apply similarly to understanding the Pliocene as a whole as to why it was warmer. And the focus has been on the Pliocene in general because it was warmer than present and was thought to be an analog for our future. But two things with that. First of all, we don't know what the CO2 was in the atmosphere during the Pliocene. We have some ideas, but the estimates range fairly broadly, so it's fairly uncertain still how much higher CO2 was that could explain the warmer temperatures and higher sea levels then. But nevertheless, let's assume it was higher. The argument would be that that would be an analog for our future at those high CO2 levels. The problem is that we're increasing CO2 by 2 to 3 parts per million in the atmosphere every year. So we've already, when they started investigating the Pliocene with this question in mind, CO2 in the atmosphere, our atmosphere, was somewhere around 350 parts per million, and they were thinking the Pliocene was maybe 400. But we've blasted through that 400 parts per million concentration in the atmosphere already, and now we're at 425 parts per million. So we're probably now well above what the Pliocene experienced. So it's not really an analog in that case because, first of all, the CO2 levels then were probably lower than they are now. And furthermore, it's very different because the CO2 levels then probably stayed at that level or similar to it, whereas what we're doing is seeing this extraordinary increase in CO2 over a very, very short period of time, which is probably pretty unique in Earth's history overall to have this amount of CO2 added to the atmosphere in such a short period of time. So at the rate we're going, and unless some serious mitigation is done, you know, we're going to be upwards of 500 to 600 to 700 parts per million or even higher by the end of the century, which would put us way past what the Pliocene level would have been. So it kind of offers an analog of an Earth that would exist under a CO2 level of 400, let's say. But we only experience that, or are going to experience that 400 level for a few years before it continues to increase well above that.
And your paper shows a pretty big transition happened around a million years ago. The cycle of ice ages and warm interglacials moved from around 41,000 years to around 100,000 years. Ice ages became more extreme with longer periods of glaciation. But why did this cycle go into longer phases?
Yeah, that's still sort of a very fundamental question. So what our paper did was we have revised that portrayal of this transition you're talking about. And in this case, this is called the mid-Pleistocene transition. So again, as you said, it occurred about a million years ago. It actually occurred between about 1.2 million and 700,000 years ago. And during that transition, the traditional view or the conventional view for basically the last 50 years since the first publication of a climate/sea level record that spanned that transition period has been that it involved not only a change in the frequency of the cycles from the shorter 41,000-year to the longer 100,000-year cycles, but also a change from smaller ice sheets to fluctuations to larger ice sheet fluctuations. So that has, again, been the long-term view until our paper has not changed the perspective that the frequency of the cycles changed from 41,000 to 100,000. But the change in the size of the fluctuations of the ice sheets did not change across the transition. They remained large since the beginning of the ice ages, about 2.6 million years ago. And from that time on, the size of the ice sheet fluctuations has been comparable to those that we last experienced 21,000 years ago at the last glacial maximum. So that's really the fundamental difference of our paper relative to the conventional thinking of this mid-Pleistocene transition. But it still leaves open the question as to why the frequency of these cycles changed from 41 to 100,000 years. And we hypothesize that that transition occurred due to a change in the frequency of fluctuations of CO2 in the atmosphere. So prior to this transition, the CO2 fluctuations were first relatively small. We're hypothesizing, we don't know for sure. But to explain the observations we have, the CO2 fluctuations were both smaller in amplitude as well as shorter in duration. That is, they were more of the line of the 41,000-year cycles. And then what happened was, though, there was still a long-term decrease in global temperature over this period of time, which we attribute to a long-term decrease in CO2, on which are superimposed these higher-frequency CO2 cycles. And with that long-term cooling about a million years ago, that changed the conditions in the Southern Ocean of the world, which is the ocean that sort of circles around Antarctica. And the thing about that area of the world is that, and that Southern Ocean in particular, is it's known to be a very important reservoir of CO2. In other words, that ocean can both hold a large amount of CO2 and release a large amount of CO2, which depends on the climate. So we argue that this long-term cooling changed the conditions in the Southern Ocean, which changed the release and absorption of CO2 to occur on this longer 100,000-year timescale or frequency. And that's then what led to the change in the frequency of the sea level fluctuations and the ice sheet fluctuations.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Oregon State Professor Peter Clark. We are looking through a lens of Earth's past. Is there a reflection of the future? Your team reconstructed sea level changes over 4.5 million years. I'm thinking that would make a great sort of 3D movie if it was sped up and you could see it going up and down the mountainsides or the coastlines. It would be great to understand it in that way. What made it possible now to create such a precise long-term record?
So the difference of our reconstruction versus former reconstructions is largely, as I said, the idea that the sea level fluctuations over the last 2.5 million years have been similar in size. They've been large throughout that time. Whereas the pre-existing sort of conventional thinking has been that since these first long records were produced 50 years ago, has been that there was this change from smaller size sea level fluctuations until about a million years ago, in which point the sea level fluctuations increased in size. So in both cases, I should say, This understanding has fundamentally been derived from a record that comes from measurements of fossils that are preserved on the seafloor. And these are fossils from microorganisms. These are small little, you might call them microorganisms or planktic-sized organisms that grow little shells like clam shells, the same composition, but they're microscopic. You can really only see them under a microscope. But in those shells is recorded, the shells themselves is recorded the chemistry of the ocean at which time they formed. And the main part of the shell composition that we're interested in is the oxygen in this shell, and the specifically two isotopes of oxygen, which is the oxygen 18 and oxygen 16. So the two isotopes differ in their mass or weight. And the variations of those isotopes in the shells record changes in climate and sea level together, so that when sea level is lower and climate is colder, that ratio of O18 to O16 in the shell increases, and when sea level rises and climate warms, that ratio of O18 to O16 decreases. So they've been making the measurements on these shells that have been recovered from going out to sea on ships and dropping cores down to the seafloor and bringing cores back up to the ship, taking to the lab and measuring in those shells the oxygen isotopic composition of them. So that work's been going on since the 1950s, when this whole understanding of oxygen isotopes in shells was first documented. But again, it wasn't until 1975 that the first long record of this variation in the isotopes was first published, and that was the first to span this period of time we're interested in, the last 2+ million years. And so that's where the details of the record come from in terms of the timing of these fluctuations and so forth. But the problem has been that shell is recording two things. First of all, it's recording the temperature of the water in which it's growing, and it's also recording the composition of the water in which it's growing. And those are two independent variables. So unless you know one, you don't know the other. So unless you know temperature, you don't know sea level. Unless you know sea level, you don't know temperature. And so it's always been some mix of the two that scientists have tried to understand but not been able to separate the effects of the two. So there have been efforts over the years to do that, but they've done it with an approach that basically reproduces the record you see in the shells themselves. So what we did that was different was we came up with a way to, first of all, reconstruct the ocean temperature over this period of time, and that's another story in itself. But once we know the ocean temperature, we can remove that temperature part of the isotopic composition of the shells, which leaves behind the seawater composition that's preserved in the shells. And from the seawater composition of the oxygen isotopic composition, it's from that we then computed the sea level reconstruction. And so that was what was different with our study. And we also were able to account for another important effect on that seawater chemistry of the oxygen isotopes and the changes in it, which is that early in this period of time, the Pleistocene, so let's say 2.5 million years ago, global temperature was warmer than present, and that's been known, and we published that last year in Science as well. And since then, temperature has been decreasing, global temperature has been decreasing. So the importance of that is that the ice sheets under those warmer climates will actually be different in their isotopic composition as compared to ice sheets that grow and decay under colder climates. And if you have to account for that effect on the seawater composition, I know this is complicated, but this is what we did. And so by accounting for that effect, that warmer climates will give ice sheets that have different compositions than ice sheets under colder climates, that further results in our reconstruction finding these large fluctuations in the early Pleistocene that were not reconstructed before based on methods that were used.
All right, so our listeners are picturing a graph of ups and downs of sea level over about 4 million years or more. Yep. What can that tell us about projected future sea level rise under global warming? Can it give us any suggestions?
Not directly, because first of all, there are two ice sheets on the Earth today. There's the Greenland ice sheet and there's the Antarctic ice sheet. And they have existed basically for this last 4 million year period. So the big sea level fluctuations we're looking at and reconstructed in the past largely are reflecting the growth of new ice sheets that don't exist today. And those ice sheets were the big ones that were over northern North America and northern Eurasia. So they would grow, and when they grew, Greenland and Antarctica would also get larger than they are now, but not by much. And then when those other large ice sheets melted away, Greenland and Antarctica would shrink, but again, not by much. So what we're looking at are really two other ice sheets that no longer exist and their fluctuations. And so they're not directly analogous or comparable in many respects to Greenland and Antarctica. In some respects they are, but because they are different, then you can't directly make a comparison to what's happened in Greenland and Antarctica. The second thing that's different is that why we use caution in taking our results to say anything about the future, is that, as I was mentioning before, the CO2 increase that's occurring, has been occurring over the last 150 years, is extremely unusual, and it's all probably unique in Earth's history. So we've had higher CO2 fluctuations in the past, but they occurred much more gradually. So the increase in CO2 and the decrease in CO2 that would have occurred naturally in the past were changing over tens of thousands of years, unlike what's happening today, where it's changing over decades. And so that's a very different forcing of the system than what has happened naturally. And because that different forcing is occurring, then you don't necessarily think that the response of the system is necessarily going to be comparable. So you have to use caution there as well. And then thirdly, we're only looking at we're just starting to wake up these ice sheets today with respect to their responding to the warming that's been occurring. It's just a very short-term effect, and it's just the beginnings of the effect that's occurred over the last few tens of years in terms of ice sheets today. And again, which is very short compared to the tens of thousands of years of changes in ice sheets that we've seen in the past. So there are lessons we can learn from our study that relate to the future, but not directly. We can't take direct analogs of the past and apply it to the future, but we can learn lessons from the past that if we want ice sheets to exist under warmer climates, then what our study found, as was the case in that we found for our study, those ice sheets have to be really big, because when they're big, they're tall, and the tops of the ice sheets exist high up in the atmosphere where it's very cold, and thus that prevents the melting. What's happening today, and this may happen in the future, though, with Greenland and Antarctica, especially with Greenland, is the height of the ice sheet will be lowering, and so it won't be able to survive the warmer climate because it's been lowering. The Antarctic ice sheet is more complicated because not only will the height of the ice sheet be possibly lowering in the central part, but the peripheral parts of the ice sheet will be changing because of what's happening at the base of the ice sheet, and those are processes that don't apply to Greenland. So for a variety of reasons, what's happening to the ice sheets today is both in terms of the forcing that's happening and the time scale which is all happening is very, very different than what's happened in the past. So there are some lessons, but for the most part, we can't apply our reconstruction to say much about what we might expect in the future.
Peter, do we need to reconstruct sea level rise going even further back into time, and can we?
We can. So again, this oxygen isotope record that's preserved in marine microfossils goes back over 100 million years. And from it, they've tried to separate the effects of temperature on that record compared to sea level. And so they can perhaps apply the same methodology we did now to do that. And from that, they've actually found that about 30 million years ago, prior to then, there was virtually no ice on the planet. And so that isotope record was just recording temperature. And it wasn't until about 30 million years ago that the first spurt of growth of the Antarctic ice sheet occurred. And now you've got these competing effects synchronous effects of ice sheets and temperature on the marine microfossils. So, yeah, they can continue to tease apart these two effects on that isotope ratio in the past and learn more about how Antarctica itself, which is then going to be more analogous to what's happening today, would have changed under warmer climates back then, which again would be more analogous to the, our future. So if you want to sort of draw these analogies to the future, you really need to go further back in time when CO2 levels were higher, much higher than present. And also we only had the ice sheets like today on the planet. In fact, Greenland probably didn't exist, but you still had Antarctica. That gives you a more apples-to-apples type of comparison to the future as compared to looking at the fluctuations of the Pleistocene that we examined.
So, as we wrap up, what are you working on these days?
I'm working on several different things. One is that we're continuing to use our new results to investigate how they might apply to other questions that we didn't evaluate. We're also looking at changes in the ocean heat content over the past 2 million years and what that implies about the Earth's energy balance and response to climate forcing and several other things.
From Oregon State University, we've been speaking with Dr. Peter Clark. He is lead author of the new paper, Global Mean Sea Level Over the Past 4.5 Million Years, published October 16th, 2025 in the journal Science. Find more in my show in the blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Peter, thank you for this new science and talking with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to do so.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Dr. Kevin Trenberth is a longtime distinguished scholar at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. Now in New Zealand, after hundreds of papers, Kevin is still publishing on things like high temperatures in the ocean in 2024 and distinctive pattern of global warming in ocean heat content. From Auckland, Kevin Trenberth, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Happy to be here.
Before we get to crops and the existential threats to civilization, I have been saving a question for you, Kevin. Right here on Radio EcoShock, you told us about a huge loss of fish and marine mammals because of a marine heat wave in the North Pacific a few years ago. Since then, just this year, we had a months-long blob of hot water stretching right across the North Pacific, and that's only breaking down now. What do you make of this latest North Pacific ocean heat event?
Yes, so we've studied extensively the flow of heat through the climate system, and there have been substantial changes in the North Pacific in particular, also in the South Pacific where I am in New Zealand area. But the North Pacific has been quite unusual, and the weather patterns certainly seem to have changed in that region. Our analysis shows that the overall jet stream over the oceans in the Northern Hemisphere, it applies to the Pacific and the Atlantic, and the associated overall storm tracks have tended to move a little bit polewards, a little bit closer towards Alaska in the Pacific region. And recently, there was a typhoon or an ex-typhoon that went up into Alaska and caused a tremendous amount of flooding. And so this is one of the symptoms of the change in climate, which is not fully understood.
It is interesting you raise this. You told us more than 90% of Earth's energy imbalance in the past half century has accumulated in the ocean, and the oceans are not heating up evenly, though. In your April 2025 paper, you and co-authors explore that strange fact. More heating shows up in the mid-latitudes, like the North Pacific and Atlantic. Why is that happening, and why aren't equatorial waters heating up as much as we might expect?
Yes, so I think a lot of it does indeed relate to water. You know, what happens when there is extra heat available? And so part of this is from the changes in the composition of the atmosphere, but part of it is also associated with clouds and feedbacks from clouds, which really complicate things. And so in the tropics, it's dominated by ocean regions, and the oceans are much more dynamic than they are in the middle to high latitudes. And so if you start dumping heat into the tropics, then it evokes changes like the El Nino phenomenon, and the currents begin to change and move.